Hello everyone, and welcome to the Actors Podcast, a bi-weekly program dedicated to bringing you closer to the difference makers in CDI and to sharing the latest news relevant to the CDI profession and to actors. My name is Rebecca Hendren and I am the Director of Actors. Also my pleasure to be your host for today's program. Our topic today is respiratory failure, and my guests are Jordan Trappan, BSN, MSN, ED, RN, TCRN, Clinical Documentation Education and Compliance Consultant for the Banner Health CDI team, and Marcy Johnson, RN CCDS, the Associate Director of the Senior Review Team at Banner Health, both in Arizona. As a quick reminder, we do offer 0.5 active CEUs for the first 4 days after posting, and you can use those towards your CCDS or your CCDS-O recertification requirements. I will share the instructions at the end of the show, so make sure you stay tuned for that. And welcome to the program, Jordan and Marcy. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you so much for having us. We're so honored to be here.
Yes, thank you, Rebecca, and the ACTIS community. We're excited to be here.
And you are talking today about one of the topics that I know our ACTIS community is always interested in hearing about, because it really is a perennial problem for CDI specialists, and that is respiratory failure. So to start off today, can you talk a little bit about why respiratory failure does remain such a problem for CDI specialists?
I love this question. I think one of the things that's very interesting and honestly valuable among CDI specialists is the varying clinical background and clinical experience of CDI specialists. But regardless of your clinical experience, respiratory failure is complex for many reasons. There's the documentation complexity. Respiratory failure requires precise clinical criteria to be met and documented. That can include specific diagnostic indicators, PaO2 levels, oxygen saturation, ventilator settings, ABG results, all of which have to be clearly documented and recorded. There's also the acute versus chronic distinction, differentiating between acute respiratory failure, acute on chronic respiratory failure, or just chronic respiratory failure, significantly impacts code assignment and reimbursement. And then there's a type specification. So is this respiratory failure hypoxemic? Is it hypercapnic? Whatever the type of respiratory failure, it must be clearly identified. There's also some clinical gray areas around this diagnosis. So these could include subjective thresholds. Providers may recognize respiratory compromise clinically, but not document it using, specific terminology required for coding. Or they see impending respiratory failure or actual respiratory failure, and they intervene quickly, and, a lot of those signs and symptoms did not get captured because they were treated so early and effectively. I can think of, I'm an ICU nurse, but we would get a patient from the ER that was crashing, and, they got intubated. There was so much care. There was so much going on with the patient, but there was no documented vitals on the patient for maybe an hour. And that's because the team were so busy giving good care that in that emergent situation, they didn't, document. Another gray area is the evolving presentation. In these situations, respiratory status can fluctuate. Like they're up, they're down. It makes it really challenging to capture the most accurate snapshot of that patient's condition. And finally, in the clinical gray areas, there are multiple contributing factors. in many patients. So what are the patient's underlying conditions? Do they have COPD? Do they have pneumonia, CHF? These comorbid conditions can complicate the primary diagnosis. Another area that respiratory failure highly impacts, of course, is financial and quality metrics. SOI, ROM, severity of illness and risk of mortality, respiratory failure significantly affects these calculations. And like I just said a minute ago, when there are multiple contributing factors, it can really impact DRG assignment. Is it the underlying cause? Is the underlying cause the principal diagnosis, or is the respiratory the principal diagnosis? And I think these situations can be challenging for CDI, especially if you know you're newer to the role. The last thing I want to mention, particularly for quality metrics, is defining respiratory failure as a complication versus a comorbidity. I could talk to you all day about PSI 11. I love PSIs, but I'm not going to get distracted. I think this area can be particularly challenging for CDIs to navigate and understand, and that's okay because it's very complex, and these cases often take, you know, very careful review and close attention to the details. Another reason this is a perennial problem is provider education challenges. Clinical versus coding language. So the provider could document, you know, respiratory distress without using respiratory failure. Query fatigue, that's a real concern around us trying to accurately capture the medical record while also respecting the hard work that our providers do. And then documentation burden, adding the required specificity takes time in an already busy day for a provider. And then finally, to wrap up this question, and I think it's one of the most important issues on this topic, is regulatory scrutiny. Respiratory failure is one of the highest diagnoses, and these diagnoses face, you know, increased auditor attention due to their financial impact. So making our documentation accurate and defensible is very essential.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I think Marcy covered it very well there. As simple as we try to make respiratory failure, it's a very complex condition, and we can't just take simple diagnostic criteria and, you know, make it black and white. There is a lot of gray within this diagnosis.
Absolutely. So, Jordan and Marcy, what clinical indicators are essential to support a diagnosis of respiratory failure?
Clinical indicators for respiratory failure should reflect the inability of the respiratory system to effectively exchange oxygen and to remove carbon dioxide. To accurately support this diagnosis, there is three essential clinical indicators that should be present. You should have symptoms, provided treatment, and abnormal gas exchange. You know, core symptoms could be dyspnea, shortness of breath, wheezing, cyanosis, the use of accessory muscles, labored breathing, on and on. You know, overall, though, the visible indicators that the respiratory system is not functioning effectively are there. Looking beyond the localized respiratory symptoms, we may see manifestations in other body symptoms, such as, you know, that increase in demand then is translated to the cardiac system and you have tachycardia. We can also see, on the contrary, you know, impaired gas exchange can cause a decrease in your neurological status, causing neurological changes such as somnolence, altered mental status, or decreasing that respiratory rate due to the hypoxia or hypercapnia. In cases with true organ failure, we should also be observing a robust clinical response from our bedside care team. You know, this would include escalation beyond minimal oxygen support. additional interventions such as nebulized bronchodilators, the use of BiPAP, CPAP, sustained supplemental oxygen, and it could also lead to possible intubation with ventilation, but that's not a requirement. You know, looking at treatments kind of beyond, again, the respiratory system, looking at underlying etiologies, you know, that can be relevant to this diagnosis, such as administering diuretics like Lasix for volume overload, or having that additional dialysis session to remove that fluid. You know, all of these interventions further support that clinical picture of respiratory failure. Looking at like the big key indicator that a lot of people look for is the abnormal gas exchange itself. As Marcy was saying, it can be categorized into three different subgroups. You've got acute, chronic, and then you have acute on chronic respiratory failure, along with hypoxic or hypercapnic respiratory failure. So understanding a patient's past medical history is really crucial, because each of these categories have different thresholds for what constitutes an abnormal PO2, PCO2, or PF ratio, or if the PF ratio is even a diagnostic criteria that should be getting used. For acute respiratory failure, you know, we're looking for that decrease in PO2 below 60, or that SpO2 below 89% on room air. PCO2 that needs to be greater than 50, but you also want that dropping acidic pH of 7.35 or less. You know, this is an acuity where the PF ratio is applicable and can be applied. So looking at that appropriately and getting a value that's less than 300. With patients, though, with chronic respiratory failure, you know, we have to look at them differently. They have different baseline oxygenation and ventilation standards compared to those who are coming in and experiencing an acute event. The significant clinical indicators for someone with chronic respiratory failure would be that continuous need and dependence on oxygen outside of the acute care setting, or a patient who has that baseline elevated PCO2 that you see in COPD and conditions along those lines, but their pH is normal because their body has led to compensation and it's utilizing those mechanisms to compensate. For an acute on chronic event, we're looking for those increased needs. So you have that patient with this chronic underlying condition, but we need to see that chronic go beyond and having those increased O2 demands to maintain that higher than 89%. Also, you know, looking at it from the other aspect, you know, having an increase in that baseline PCO2 greater than 10, or a PCO2 that's greater than 50 with, again, that dropping pH because it's no longer able to compensate for that chronic underlying condition because we're having that greater demand placed. So recognizing that each acuity level has a varying clinical criteria to diagnose and appropriately applying that criteria, it's going to help ensure you have accurate interpretation of those gas exchanges. And then overall, looking at the clinical picture of the patient, you know, and recognizing and appropriately seeing these clinical indicators and then applying them to the diagnosis of respiratory failure. You know, it's definitely three areas that have to be evaluated and applied, and making sure that we're looking at a full clinical picture of the patient before we jump on this diagnosis.
Absolutely. So how do you recommend people query for respiratory failure?
Having clearly established clinical indicators for respiratory failure, I feel like is very vital for CDI teams, but the true key often lies in recognizing trends. Rather than relying on single abnormal values based upon the criteria, you know, while indicators such as ABG results, pulse ox readings, PF ratios, and symptoms, they can all contribute to respiratory failure, they bring the most meaning when viewed over time. You know, for example, like a single low oxygen saturation of 87% on room air, that may simply reflect that a blood pressure was taken on the same arm as a pulse ox rather than true respiratory compromise. So this is why trending can really be essential when you're looking at queries for respiratory failure. When introducing any diagnosis, really, that depends on vital signs or laboratory values. Consistent patterns over time provide more clinical backing and confidence to support the diagnosis. You know, with respiratory failure specifically, ABGs may not always be available in multiple sets. You know, that is an invasive procedure, but trends can still be demonstrated through repeat vital signs and symptom progression. You know, for respiratory failure specifically, showing a trend of respiratory rates that are consistently above 20 breaths per minute, or an SpO2 that is continuing to decline or failing to respond to oxygen supplementation. Having the trend provides a much stronger clinical foundation than providing just a single abnormal reading. You know, having a trend also from a query and denial prevention standpoint, which I know we're all, you know, hot topic denials.
That's right.
You know, trends help to ensure the clinical picture is complete, and it also can, you know, prevent that perception of a leading query. You know, when you only provide that single diagnostic criterion, it can appear as though the CDI specialist is guiding the provider towards a diagnosis without having that sufficient evidence to support that diagnosis. Where in contrast, if you offer that broader context through multiple sets of diagnostic criteria, it helps to present both supportive, and it could even possibly give non-supportive indicators, but it allows that provider to make that informed, unbiased decision with all of that clinical picture. You know, I always look at it from like a data analysis kind of, you know, and typically when you do data analysis, a minimum of 3 data points is needed to establish a trend. So I always recommend providing 3 sets when possible. So if we're talking about vital signs, provide 3 complete sets when possible to help present that clearer, more accurate clinical picture. And this is also just going to increase, you know, that documentation integrity and support, again, defensible, codable outcomes. So overall, when you're looking to query for respiratory failure, having that robust clinical picture and showing diagnostic trends of criteria, of symptom progression, and overall the treatment provided, it's going to help support your query and the introduction of that diagnosis better than looking at single data points.
Jordan, I agree with you so much. I love how you said, it might be the previous question, but you were talking about like altered mental status, tachycardia. I think that along with your robust trend, critical thinking is very important when you are considering this diagnosis. So I think that that was a really good point as well.
It really is. And I'm going to ask a quick question here, just to help clarify this for me. How do you differentiate between respiratory failure, respiratory distress, and respiratory insufficiency?
So the key distinguishing factor between these three, it's primarily the difference in gas exchange adequacy. In respiratory distress, the patient's effort is increased, but gas exchange may still be adequate. In insufficiency, gas exchange, it could be impaired, but there is compensation. And then from there, we'd go to respiratory failure, which is when there is critical impairment of gas exchange and the patient has decompensated. That's my quick answer. Jordan, I don't know if you have anything to add to that.
Yeah, I agree. You know, definitely taking you got to look and use that critical thinking and that critical investigation and kind of look at the patient as a whole picture. Again, kind of going back to the trend and not taking a small snippet of an instance and trying to apply that to a larger diagnosis. So really, when we're looking at these different diagnoses, it comes down to the patient's overall presentation, those gas exchanges that, as you're talking about, you know, level of treatment is also important. If the patient, you know, gets put on a couple of liters of O2 and then 2 hours later is getting taken off of that O2, is that truly a respiratory failure, or is that right, more of a respiratory insufficiency issue at that point? So really utilizing our critical thinking and applying the knowledge that we have about these diagnoses to the whole clinical picture versus kind of zooming in and looking at these small snippets sometimes that we tend to do because we see numbers and we go, ooh, maybe this is a query opportunity, and we get really excited and that's awesome and amazing. And, you know, we want that thinking and that process, but then to maybe take that step back and realize that we need to look at it broader.
Yeah. Well, that was interesting there, Jordan. I mean, you were basically talking about documentation pitfalls with that, with seeing that number and getting exciting and wondering if there is a query. And that was my next question, is what are the most common documentation pitfalls?
Oh, there's a few. I think one of the most common documentation pitfalls is lack of specificity. So failing to specify acute versus chronic, you know, those three types of respiratory failure. And then not documenting the type. Is it hypoxic? Is it hypercapnic? Is it a combination of both? Missing documentation of underlying cause or etiology. And then the ever-present omitting whether the condition was present on admission or not. I think another very important problem area with documentation is clinical criteria not being included and documented. Jordan did such a great job of identifying that clinical criteria, but we have to have that objective evidence, ABGs, oxygen saturation levels, PaO2, PaCO2, lack of documenting clinical findings to the actual diagnosis. That's another area. And then insufficient details about severity and acuity. I will never underestimate a well-documented physical assessment. When you get one of those, it's gold. And then not documenting ventilatory or oxygen support requirements. You know, Jordan had an example of maybe you have a patient that went on 2 liters O2, maybe they went up to 3 liters, and then in 30 or 40 minutes, they're off oxygen. So capturing those support requirements is often a documentation pitfall. There's sometimes we see misclassification errors. This can include confusing acute exacerbation of chronic respiratory failure with, you know, is it truly chronic? Is it acute? Jordan also mentioned that sometimes these patients' baselines look very different than someone who doesn't have that chronic issue. Incorrectly documenting respiratory distress as respiratory failure. Really glad you asked that previous question, Rebecca. And then, distinguishing between respiratory insufficiency, distress, and failure. And then not recognizing when acute respiratory failure has resolved. I think that's something we do see. And then there's the ever-present incomplete or inconsistent documentation, the dreaded copy-paste. the diagnosis could be mentioned by one provider, but not consistently documented, whether that's a consult, say maybe pulmonology. They're documenting it, but the attending isn't. Query responses not being incorporated into progress notes or discharge summaries, that kind of thing.
We are just about out of time, but I didn't want to end this conversation without asking a very important question, which is about provider education. So how do you approach provider education?
Oh, thank you for this question. Before we dive in, I just want to say our department has a physician advisor, and he's made such a significant difference in our provider education. So shout out to all the physician advisors. I think one of the most important things to do in provider education for a diagnosis like respiratory failure is to establish clinical criteria framework. You need to have very clear, defined thresholds. We have, a blurb on our query template for respiratory failure that does include what industry best practice is. You know, we also present on this criteria to our providers throughout the year. I think it's also important to emphasize clinical context, respiratory rate, work of breathing, mental status changes, and then links to interventions. So need for mechanical ventilation, BiPAP, high flow oxygen. We use case-based learning, like case studies. We find them to be very impactful for our physicians. We present real de-identified cases showing proper versus improper documentation. We demonstrate the impact on SOI and ROM. And then we also show how the documentation affects quality and metrics reimbursement. One of the tools that we've found really helpful is a DRG progression table. It can be really powerful for providers who are visual learners. We include SOI, ROM, length of stay, HCC, relative weight, all that good stuff. And then we have a very collaborative query process. We do review in real time. We've worked very hard to make sure our queries are, that they don't ever feel like we're questioning the provider's judgment. This is super important with clinical validation queries. We have query templates that are very specific to the questions we want to ask. And then we really provide feedback, and we share the outcomes of the documentation improvements. We do have regular scheduled education sessions. We have monthly workshops, and our physician advisor has been having on-site meetings with provider groups, which I think is very important because it makes those personal connections, which can make a big difference when we're in a remote environment. We also have specialty-specific training, pulmonology, critical care, maybe trauma. We also provide education to providers when they are new, so onboarding education. And we try to include documentation standards from day one. And then our operational managers share fantastic data-driven feedback with our stakeholders. And this is done quarterly. This includes a breakdown of the queries we sent and what trends we're seeing in documentation. And it really helps to demonstrate the correlation between documentation quality and patient outcomes. And then finally, I feel like a big piece of provider education is addressing the common misconceptions, clarifying that respiratory failure is a clinical diagnosis, not just a lab value. You have to have all the pieces of the puzzle fit together to create respiratory failure. explain why specificity matters for accurate severity assignment, and then, you know, demonstrate how to properly document, how to create that documentation that supports quality initiatives and appropriate resource allocation, which will ultimately lead to accurate reimbursement.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much. Unfortunately, we have run out of time. I know I could ask you more questions about this topic, but I do want to thank you, Jordan and Marcy, ever so much for joining me today to talk about respiratory failure.
It was our honor. Thank you so much for having us here. And thank you to the ACTUS team and for all the things that you guys do for us as a community out here.
Yeah, this was fantastic. I had such a good time being here today with Jordan and with you, Rebecca. Thank you so much.
And as always, if our audience has any questions about this topic, you can feel free to email the ACTUS team at info@actus.org. And now it's time for something completely different, the ACTUS Update, our regular segment featuring the latest news of what's going on inside your association. Firstly, I want to tell you that our annual ACTUS Community Survey is open until March 3rd. And we do ask both members and non-members to share your feedback and any requests you might have for the ACTUS team and what we work on in the upcoming year. We use the information that you give us in this annual survey to guide our coverage and improvements for everything from hot topics to how we improve our current member benefits, improve our free resources, including this podcast and other free resources that we provide, and suggestions for future products or services. So please do take a few minutes, give us your opinion. We really do take all of that to heart, and we use it to plan out what we're going to be offering you. You can find the link to take that survey in today's show notes. And also, we are only 2 months away from the ACTUS conference, which is taking place this year in the beautiful city of Chicago from April 20th to 23rd. So it's going to be a lovely springtime conference in Chicago. I want to take a minute to highlight the exciting pre-conference events that we have, which truly are their own smaller conferences. They really do stand on their own, and you can attend them on their own, or of course you can combine them with a trip to the main conference. Firstly, if you're thinking of sitting for the CCDS credential in the next year or so and would like to attend an in-person study session, I'm excited to let you know that we have a new option this year. We have launched the CCDS Exam Prep Pre-Conference. At this, you can join ACTUS instructors Kelly Rice and Lynette Biley for 2 intensive days of study to ensure you feel ready to sit for the exam and to be successful. You're really in great hands with Kelly and Lynette. They spend all day, every day teaching CDI, so they really are going to be the best people to spend a couple of days with to find out everything that you want to know or were feeling nervous about that you may need to brush up on. So please do check out the links in our show notes for more information about that. And of course, we also have our 2 returning events, the ACTUS Symposium Outpatient CDI, along with the ACTUS Physician Advisor Forum. Both of these feature multiple tracks. They have tons of amazing speakers, an inspirational keynote, and even a mini exhibit hall. So lots going on to check out. A lot of fun going to be had in Chicago in April. And of course, any of these 3 pre-conference events can be bundled with the main conference to save. And we did extend the early bird discount until March 3rd. So sign up now for some great savings. Check out the links in the show notes if you want to know more or to see the agendas for all these exciting programs. Now, unfortunately, we have come to an end of the program. So before I close us out, as a reminder, you can earn 0.5 ACTUS CEUs, which you can use toward recertifying your CCDS or CCDSO credential. But you must listen to the show in the first 4 days from the time of publication. What you have to do is go to the show page on ACTUS.org by clicking on the ACTUS podcast link under the free resources tab. Then simply find today's episode from the list on that page. You can scroll down to the recording of today's episode and click play. Once you've listened to the whole episode, you have to wait for the video to actually get to the end. The timer says 0. A link to the CEU evaluation will appear. You click on that, take the survey, and your certificate will be emailed to you upon submitting the brief evaluation. You can also read those instructions on the show page, so you can follow along there too. Now, to ensure your certificate reaches you and doesn't get trapped in your organization's spam filters, we do like to suggest that you use a personal email address when completing that form. And as a reminder, the cutoff for today's episode is Sunday, March 1st at 11 p.m. Eastern. After that point, the CEU period will close. However, you can still listen to the excellent episode, and you can always go back and listen to any episode that you might have missed. And never fear, if you miss that CEU opening, there'll be another ACTIS podcast coming along in 2 weeks. We are regular schedule every 2 weeks. It's always going to be a new program. So on Wednesday, March 11th, we have a new episode hosted by my esteemed colleague, Linnea Archibald, who is our Associate Editorial Director of Publications and Membership. I know there's going to be another great show. And if you want to receive reminders about each episode, make sure you don't miss anything, then simply ensure you're subscribed to our free weekly e-newsletter, CDI Strategies, which always includes a link to the latest podcast that has been released. You can listen to the show at any time on any device with the ACTIS website, or you can listen to it via your favorite podcast app, whether that's Apple, Spotify, or whatever else you might use. And don't forget, any links we talked about will be in the show notes. As always, if you are listening on a podcast app, please do take a minute to leave us a 5-star review. It does help others find our show. Our intro and outro music is Media Noche by D. Yankee, and our ad music is Take Me Higher by Jazzar, both obtained from the Free Music Archive. If you have suggestions for future guests or topics, just shoot us an email at info@actis.org. Until next time, cheerio everyone!